Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is the Best Hang Podcast featuring Max Kerman, Shane Cunningham, and I am Mike Bierman. Here's a secret, you can pass it around. Here's a secret, you can pass it around. My head in the clouds, hands and feet on the ground. Here's a secret, you can pass it around. All right. Welcome to the Best Hang Podcast. I'm Mike, we got Max, we got Shane, and we also have the author of The Whispers. You've been hearing us talk about this for a long time, weeks leading up to this, and it's an exciting moment for us. We're recording this at Max's place. We have the author, Ashley Audrain. Welcome, Ashley. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This might be the smartest pod we've ever had, like with a real intellect on the show. And actually, when we announced that we were going to have you on and we were going to do a book club, our listeners were like, they can read these guys? But also... Thank you, Max. I was like looking at Shane. But then the other day I was on the street, like just maybe three blocks from here on Dover Court, and someone like was riding on their bike behind me and just yelled at me like, yo, where's the book club? Whispers, what's up? Let's go. And it was like this lady.
It was a lady with a weird New York accent.
Yeah, I just got back from
You here. Love voice work every chance you get.
I know our listeners are very excited. And when I posted on our Kel's account that I love the book, I had so much feedback about it.
Thank you.
Yeah. The backstory with getting to know you is that you and Ash know each other from a previous life.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of was curious about how you transitioned from a book publicist to an international bestselling author. Cause I'd like to do the same.
You want to be a book publicist?
Well, no, just the second
oh,
part.
Oh, the second part. The wild success. Yeah.
How did it happen? Well, so I worked in public relations for most of my career, like for eight or 10 years in the PR agency world. And then I had a chance to move over to do sort of that same thing at Penguin Canada and worked there for a couple years. And the reason I moved over to work in publishing was because I've always just loved books and reading and writing. And I sort of got a bit sort of, you know, you work in PR for long enough and you sort of get a bit, you know, tired of it, or you're sort of doing all this work for these big brands. And I kind of wanted to do something.
There's a lot of dummies in PR too. Honestly, like I imagine you have to be smarter to be a book publicist and like know how to write, because sometimes we work with a lot of good publicists. Mm-hmm. We've worked with so many dummy publicists who like can't even write a sentence. So like, do you have to like pass a written test or something when you work for Penguin?
No, but I was really nervous to go work for Penguin because it is a totally different world. Like you go from working with, you know, like brands and marketing and these big, fun, silly ideas to an environment that was definitely more serious and more literary. And it was like a big transition, but ultimately you're sort of doing the same thing. It's the same sort of skill set. Mm. But I was like a kid in a candy store working at Penguin, because you just go in every day with all the authors and the books and the editors. And I was so excited to be so close to that process, you know, to like learn more about that. And I'd always wanted to write. Like I had always you know, when I was young, I always felt like a writer. I was always writing, like when I was in high school, I was always writing like letters to the editor and and writing for, you know, like there was this zine, this fun zine in university. And I was always looking for ways to write, but didn't pursue that like at the level of a novel or something different. I did a lot of like night courses at like George Brown or Humber. Mm. And was just always trying to stay close to it. But working in publishing was just, it was so cool to be like really immersed in that. And I learned a lot from that experience. I actually didn't write much when I was at Penguin. I think because there was this intimidation factor, you know, of like working with, you know, real writers and real novelists.
Do you feel a lot of pressure writing emails to people? Because I've exchanged a few emails to people in the book world, and every one of them writes like is a poem or some like, you know, New Yorker article or something.
Yeah.
And even when I've texted you, I feel a lot of pressure texting you. Yeah, because I'm like,
how are texts?
They're pretty good, actually. You have really good text.
Really?
Yeah.
But yours are like beautiful paragraphs.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah. I'm interested, you know, because you hear this story sometimes where people work in the industry and work with sort of established, whether it's like artists, music, or authors. How do you sort of feel, oh, I can hang at this level? Like, where do you get the confidence? Was it inherent to you? Like, oh, I know I'm a good writer? Or did you have to sort of just try and be like, I think I'm as good as everybody I'm working with?
No, I think that was why I didn't write at all when I was working there. And so what happened was I read a lot there. Like, you really, when you work in publishing, you read like an insane amount of books because you have to read the books that you're promoting and the books that are important to your editors that you're working for. And I feel like that was this really interesting sort of different education in itself for writing. Because I think that reading is really the best way to improve your writing or to think more about writing. So I was mostly sort of reading, just consuming and thinking and trying to think more like a writer, I think. But how I started writing was, so I went on maternity leave with my son, and I had planned to just, you know, do the regular maternity leave and go back to work because I really loved that job, like loved it. But when he was born, so everything was okay for kind of the first 2 weeks. And then at around 2 weeks old, he became really, really sick. And we realized that he had a chronic illness and he had like some pretty complex problems. And so then life like totally changed, like life already changes after having a kid. But when you have a kid who is so sick and was dealing with these problems, it was just very overwhelming and everything really turned then. And we spent like months living at SickKids and hospitals and like all of it. It was a lot. And I realized at that time that like I wasn't going to be able to go back to work. Like that was not part of my reality. It was sort of that job has a lot of like late nights and just the whole environment. I felt like I just can't go back and do that anymore. So that was around like, I think around six, when he was about 6 months old. And I sort of started to kind of like gain my footing back around that time. And we weren't at SickKids so much anymore. And I thought, like, I just thought, okay, if I'm not going to go back to work and everything is just so different and it was so hard, I thought, like, what do I really want to do? I really just want to be writing. Like, that was the only thing I wanted to do. And I felt at that time that, I don't know if you guys felt this becoming parents too, but for me, there was something so creative about having kids. Like it was like the creativity was just like so there on the surface.
Like logistics or what do you mean?
Like all of it. It just,
I don't have a kid. So yeah.
Logistically, the creativity was actually very hard. Mm-hmm. I would say that was the problem, but it was more,
it's like inspiration.
Yeah,
yes.
It was like inspiring. Yes. And it's sort of, I mean, on so many different levels, like on one level, I was talking to, just the other day to like an actress who is pregnant and she's filming something right now. And she was saying,
spill the name, give us a name.
I'll tell you after. And she was saying that she felt like now when she's acting, like the emotions are, the way she put it was like the emotions are on her skin and she can just like pluck them for like, it's all just right there. And like acting became different for her. And I can so relate to that. Like that idea that, I don't know, I just felt like, I think there's something about just how emotional that process was, how hard motherhood was for me. Like it was a really hard time having a baby, but also a baby that had like the challenges that my son did. And it was all just there on the surface. And I just really, I felt so compelled to be like exploring that. Like I felt very, like the other reason I just felt so compelled to write, I think, is because I felt like you really lose a part of yourself when you become a mother, I think. Like you lose so much of not even like who you were, but almost like who you thought you'd be, or like, it's just such a life-changing thing. And I think that it's almost like a way of kind of like find, like holding on to this piece of yourself that you value the most, or that you treasure the most. You know, there was something about that for me, I think. And also this idea, like, I guess on like a bigger level, that's, and maybe you'd relate to this more as a parent too, is this idea that, like, I feel like as soon as I had a kid, you're just like, whoa, you are somebody's mother. And like, yeah. How do you want to show up in the world? You know, like, who do you want to be in this world? And you have this sense of like, I want that kid to have a mom who is like doing exactly the thing she's meant to do, and like exactly the thing she loves doing in this life, you know? And so I felt like motivated on that level. I don't know if that resonates with you guys.
Do you see people? So you obviously spend a lot of time in the hospital, and you're interacting with people in a much different way, because it's less about me to you. So maybe were you examining people in a deeper way and in a different way, instead of just saying, "Oh, I saw my doctor." I'm like, I'm not seeing my doctor. I'm seeing my kid's doctor. So I'm going to look at that. Like, what is this? You're kind of analyzing it in a completely different way, because it's like through the kid. Is that how you mean, when it's like a heightened sense of awareness?
Total, all of that. I think all of that. And you know what's so interesting, like, which I hated, is that when you have a child at like a place like Sick Kids, which is just the most wonderful, this is going to sound like a criticism, but it's the most wonderful place in the world. I'm so grateful to Sick Kids, and we're still there all the time and very involved there. But they, when you are, especially I think when you have like a baby, they call you mom. They only call you mom. And so everyone just stops using your name. And I understand why, because there's like, you know, hundreds of parents in the hospital and they know your child's name. But like so I like had this baby, and then it was so hard. And then 2 weeks later, you're in the hospital for months, and like no one uses your name the whole time. And it's such a loss, like an awful loss of identity, you know? So there's like, so yeah, it was just this, you're just coming at it all from such a different place. And yeah, the whole thing. Like I remember my friends, I had lots of friends that had kids around the same time, and they were all doing all the baby stuff, right? Like going to the yoga classes and going to the groups and all this stuff. And I was like, I had like no interest in that. Like I just couldn't engage in any of that, because my experience was just so different. And I knew that they couldn't relate to me at all anymore, and I couldn't really relate to them. And it was just very isolating. And so I think also turning to writing, and especially my first book, The Push, is very much about this woman's very dark experience through motherhood, through the earlier stage of motherhood. And I think I just wanted, it was like me in the book, you know, me in the writing, like that, that was a place where I could just, through a woman who's having obviously a very different experience than I did, but it was a place to really explore that on the page and work out a lot of those, that sort of darker side, a lot of the fear and all of that.
Going back a bit, you went to Western. Mm-hmm. And now when you went to Western, did you go with the intention of being a writer?
No, I didn't.
I was wondering, because it's like interesting that you have this career, obviously in publishing, it's writing adjacent, but not writing. Like, I'm just always fascinated by like people that are like, what makes somebody a writer? Is it being published? Is it being proud of your own work? Is it somebody saying it's good? How did you sort of reach the point where you're like, oh, I'm a writer and I know I'm good at this?
That's a great question. Yeah. I think, you know, when I went to Western, I didn't pursue like writing, but I was really interested in media. Like that's all I wanted to do was like pop culture media. And they have a program there called Media and Information Technoculture, which is still around, but it was this really small program that was just all about like, critiquing media, like critical theory. So I really loved that world, and there was a lot of writing in that world, but I think I always knew I was like a strong writer. Like I loved writing. I'd always had like good feedback on writing in my life, like through like school and stuff. And I just could feel it. I just knew I just always felt like a writer. That's like part of just what I identified with, I think. And then I didn't really, like when I started writing, when my son was around 6 months old and I started writing the first book, it took me like a long time to show that to anybody. Like I worked on it for several years and revised it and like had a few people I showed it to. But there does come this sort of terrifying point in the process, I think, where you just realize that if you want your work to be better, you have to share it and get feedback and work on it. And I sort of got to that point where I thought, I can't make this any better. And you just sort of come to a point where you think, okay, this is I either have to go for this or not. And I was in this weird position where, because I'd worked for Penguin and was so close with them, I knew I had to show it to them at some point, but they didn't know me as a writer. And
you're like, what? You write?
Yeah, what exactly.
It's like a weird conversation. It's like you're I'd be like insecure. It's like, it was, it's like, do you think like a lot of people that work in the industry want or are writers?
And they probably have to go, like, oh, you know? There's another publicist who wants to be a writer.
That's how I felt. God. That's exactly how I felt. I felt like they're all going to be like, oh God, here she goes. And I sort of had just disappeared because I was supposed to come back and I just had sort of disappeared with this kid and that was it. So I felt scared. But it was actually funny because so Nicole Winstanley is the publisher of Penguin Canada. She's just remarkable. She's a remarkable person. But I had worked with her or for her for those years. And we had sort of kept in touch. We actually had kids around the same time that when I had my son, she also was going on mat leave. But so I knew I had something to show her and I was so scared. So we met and we had a tea together and I was so nervous the whole time because because I had to tell her that I'd done this and I didn't know really what to do next. And I kind of wanted some advice on agents and stuff.
Did she know what the tea was about or was it just a
friend
hang?
No, it was just like a
and you were just going to drop it on her.
Yeah. And I was so nervous and I think she could tell I was really nervous. And then at the end I was like, look, I have this thing I want to tell you and I'm so scared to tell you and it's going to sound weird. And she interrupted me and she was like, let me guess, you wrote a book. So fun. She's like, I always knew you're such a great writer. I always knew you'd write something. So that
How'd
was really
you know
nice.
You're a good writer, though.
I guess just from work stuff like emails. They're
important.
Yeah. Oh wow, that's so interesting.
Yeah, so that was very. It was just such a like generous, lovely like response that she had, and then I shared it with her, and then
See, I'm the opposite. The second I have like half of an idea, I call Mike. I'm like, oh, I got this idea. Yeah. I don't really know what it is, but I need you to help me figure it out. It's like I have like three lyrics in a song. Who wants to hear it? That's what I'm a singer, lead singer. But when did you show your husband, or when did you were you talking to your husband about the writing of the first book? Like when did was he poking around? Because obviously you need your own space to create, but how's that work?
Yeah, it was good.
What's he do, by the way? Tell us about it.
He's not in anything creative. He's in finance and investing. Yeah. So not in that world at all. But he's a very good, he has like a very good understanding of people. Like and so I knew he would be helpful with like the characters, with like insights into people. But actually what happened was I was pregnant with my second child, with my daughter. I'm trying to remember now. Yeah, I was pregnant with my daughter and I really wanted to get, I'd been working on it for like a couple years. This is the push. Yeah. And I really wanted to, start like sharing it with people or sending it out to agents. And I had this idea that like I would be done this book like before I had her, like before I gave birth, and then I'd be able to like just be done and then kind of pursue it later, like send it out to agents after. And so I was like pretty pregnant at that time and then like finally gave him sort of the book that I'd been working on and was like, read it, you know, can you read it and give me feedback?
Had you given any inkling of what that was
like
about?
He kind of knew. Yeah, he kind of knew, but hadn't read a lot of it. And then he read it and then he was like, well, let's go for lunch. Like, go for lunch and talk about like the book.
That
would stress
me out.
God.
Oh God.
Yeah.
Were you like, nervous at that lunch?
He was just going to tell her he wants to be a writer, actually. Yeah.
I have a book. Can you put me in touch with someone?
You got good connections.
So we went for lunch and he was like, look, this is really hard feedback to give. I feel like I feel like you're not going to like this, but I feel like 75% of the book is like just not working.
75. That's a large percentage. Crazy number.
Okay, so this is an interesting sort of question about partners and feedback. Mm-hmm. Is your instant reaction are you fuming or do you take it constructive criticism? Or?
No, I was like, fuck this guy. He doesn't know.
Yes.
He works in finance. He doesn't
know. He works
in finance. It's fucking finance, bro. He's telling me around a fucking book.
75%.
Exactly.
Okay. So
he was like this, there's this like quarter of it that he felt like was so good. And the rest of it was just kind of like meh. And so I was obviously like really pissed off at that and just thought like, I'm not going to like, whatever, I shouldn't, whatever. He doesn't really know what he's talking about. And also I was like about like very pregnant, like about to have a baby. And so it wasn't good. It just wasn't good.
Let him get you sick. You're giving me shit over my book. I'm just trying to make myself feel better.
You don't even have the appetizers yet. Like,
Exactly that. So, but then after like, I, you know, time went by and I thought about it and what he was saying was, this part that you have that's really working is like the really dark motherhood stuff, like the story about the really honest, true, raw stuff is so good. And then there's all this other stuff that I think I was writing to try to make the dark stuff not feel so heavy, you know, like I was kind of like doing a bit of what I really wanted to write about and then kind of like putting other stuff on top of it to make it feel not so.
You weren't fully committing to the dark.
So yeah, it was like a slapstick comedy and then
exactly. Yeah. And so and then I kind of came around to realizing no, he's totally right. It's like exactly what's wrong with this.
Wow.
And that the good writing is this small little bit that I can keep and the rest of it needs to go. So I came around to that and I rewrote all the rest of it. That became exactly what the push is, what you the know, book is. Yeah.
No, it speaks to his character that he was like interested in all the weirdness, because I always think about whenever I read any novel, especially ones that really get me in the weird corners of the human experience, I'm always like, what does their partner think of all this?
Yeah.
And you know, you're talking about motherhood, you're talking about relationships between, you know, marriages. And I feel like it would offend 96% of the population who's in a partnership. Like, can you imagine?
Yeah,
like,
I
you know what I mean?
That's all I was thinking. Yeah. Reading the whispers. I was like, what is your partner
thinking? That's
think
the only thing I can think of. And by the way, we're going to do a spoiler alert halfway through this.
So we're not transitioning to the whispers spoiler alert yet.
We're not getting there
yet. We're going to keep deep diving Ashley.
We can say there's lustful thoughts in the whispers, yeah. right? Like, people have wandering eyes.
Yeah.
So when your husband reads that, is he like, do you have wandering eyes? Or is he suspicious or anything?
No, I don't think he can. No, he's pretty well, it's funny with like the push, I think he didn't see it and I didn't either, honestly. Like, I don't think we really realize, like, a lot of the feedback on the push is like, oh, it's so dark and it's so honest and it's so raw, and like, I don't think we really saw it that way entirely. And maybe just said something about like our experience of parenthood. I don't know, but I don't know. And then in the whispers, he doesn't have no issues with it.
Well, I guess this is like a general question about writing. And you know, we've talked to musicians about this too. Like, when you write a song or anything, how much you hold back, how much are you worried that the people in your life think, oh, they're talking about me? As an author, you obviously must have friends in your neighborhood who think they're a Blair or a Whitney or Rebecca or whatever that is. Are you very conscious of that, where it's like, oh shit, they're gonna know I'm talking about so-and-so's husband?
Yeah, it's funny. I get that a lot. Like, yeah. A lot of people say to me, like, are you so worried about, like, yeah, what your partner's going to think, what your kids are going to think, like, your friend? And to me, it's like, it's not a memoir. Like, the books are personal to me in a sense that, I don't know if you'd feel like this with songwriting, but it's sort of like, there's truth in all, like, there's a true feeling or a true emotion or real questions or things I'm interested in or like the things I'm obsessed about, like, that's all in the book. But there, it's not like my best friend, it's not my partner, like, it's, so I think you sort of find these little bits of like truth, like, that you hope people really relate to. And I hope that readers like relate to a lot of what's in the book. But then you're like, you know, building something totally different out of that truth or out of that emotion.
Okay,
that
but feeling. If we were to go through like a character, like pick any character, because
like building a character profile.
Yeah, they're so vivid, right? Like, and would you be like, could you be like, oh, okay, if we're going to talk about Whitney, it's like, this is a composite of seven different people I know, or a movie character that I like. Could you, if you were to think deeply about it, identify, okay, this guy kind of reminds me of six different people, and I've sort of the good parts and the bad parts, or is that not the way your brain works? I'm just like, just the character composition.
There is a bit of that. It depends. Honestly, it depends on the character, but yeah, there are some characters where I'm thinking of a certain thing about a person I know. And that definitely shows up in the character. But never to the point where I hope they'd be able to identify themselves.
This is the question. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. When you're writing, do you picture an actor in your head? Do you have a complete sort of fabric, like a new sort of image of someone, or is it someone in your life? Like, what are you picturing when you're writing the characters?
I usually have an idea in my head, but it's never like an actor for some reason. It's never, because that would be too specific. You know, it has to be someone like totally different in my mind. There's a few characters though that, like, there's a character of Mara in the book The Whispers, and that is.
We've talked about this.
Yeah. And she is based off of a neighbor that I had. So I lived in this neighborhood. I lived on the street called Argyle, right around the corner. We lived there for 8 years. And I had this neighbor who was sort of a Mara type. Like, she was a Portuguese immigrant. She was just really lovely woman who literally like lived on her porch. Like, she embodied that really beautiful porch culture that a lot of like neighborhoods like this have, which actually will be gone within a generation, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Like that is like a thing that won't exist anymore.
You touch a lot of kind of sad. That in
yeah, the book. Yeah. And so we had this, she was just, I never had a conversation with her in the 8 years that I lived there because she doesn't speak any English. But she would watch our lives unfold, right? Like, she would just watch us come and go. Like, I would think about bringing our kids home from like the hospital, and she was there watching, and like first day of school, she's there watching. Like, you know, she just was observing so much about our life. And
do you think she secretly spoke English and she just wanted you to think that
so she could hear everything? Yeah.
Maybe. Well, I think she understood more than probably
I. It is interesting to have a detached witness to your life, like someone that doesn't interact with you, but somehow has seen all these milestones as you bring the kids home for the first time and you go through your day. Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, and I was really fascinated by that. And so she sort of became the inspiration for the character Mara in the book. I would always think as she was kind of watching us, I was like, wow, I wonder, like, she must be, it must be nostalgic for her. Like, she must be thinking about like her kids and her family and, you know, comparing like what motherhood looks like and just womanhood. And yeah, so I wanted to write about that. I was really interested in writing a dynamic like that. So sometimes, like, to answer your question, like, sometimes a character like that it is very much like is inspired by someone. And then other times, like, yeah, sometimes there's some, you know, stuff about a friend or whatever that I think like, oh, that's so good. Like, I have to like use that at some point. And I take a lot of notes. Like, I'm a really like obsessive note taker on my iPhone.
Voice notes or just
text. Yeah. Like write them. And I have like, yeah, like I do that constantly, like all day long. Like, I know we're all obsessed with our phones, but I like want my phone nearby because I'm going to think of something and like I have to write it down. And I use that a lot with characters and developing characters, going back to like things someone did or someone said or, yeah.
The next book is a slapstick comedy about three podcasters.
Yeah, I'd love that. Who's going to play us? We'll play ourselves. How quickly after you finished The Push did you start conceiving of The Whispers?
Oh, well, you know what? Pretty soon because, well, actually not, I guess I had finished The Push. So what happened was, I was so lucky the way that it all went with like an agent and a book deal and all. It was like magical. Like, it was like the stuff that just doesn't happen. I was so lucky.
Did it happen quick?
It did. It happened like really quick. So I had went out to this handful of agents that I thought like, okay. And this was actually advice from Nicole and Stanley, who I mentioned earlier, who just sort of said, you know what, you get like one shot at this, just go big, like go big, like go out to like the best agents in the world and just try, like just start there and try, which is such like incredible advice. I think especially as a woman, when you sort of maybe have a bit of a inclination to want to play small sometimes, you know, and she was, it was kind of what I needed to be like, okay, I do want this to be a big book and I want to have like a successful career. So I reached out to these, like, I think it was five or six of like these great agents, like in London and New York, and was so lucky to have interest from them. And one of them, Madeline Milburn, she was from London, and she said, like, we have to meet face. I was trying to make a decision on the agent, and she said, we have to meet face to face, and I'm going to be in New York next week. And would you fly to New York and just have dinner with me? And I was like, okay, sure. Yeah. It was so exciting and so fun. So I went to New York. We had this great dinner together. And I just sort of decided on the spot at dinner that like, yes, like we should work together. We just had such great chemistry and I really loved her. And then she was like, oh, so once I made that decision, like at dinner, she was like, okay, great. So I'm going to need a summary of your second book, like tomorrow morning.
Whoa.
So wow. I was like, okay, put the champagne down and like,
I'm working tonight.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, yeah. And then so I put together, and I did have the idea for The Whispers, like a lot of it. But it was just like a little idea in my head.
The title? Did you have the title at that point?
I didn't. No, no.
What, did you have an original title for it before?
No.
It was always just untitled until
I was like literally just untitled on my desktop. But so then I went home and the next morning I wrote like a summary of it. And the reason she wanted the idea is because she wanted to sell two books at once, which is wonderful, which is great. Yeah. She needed a bit of a package. Yeah. And then, so she sold, both books like literally the next day, in the UK and then Canada and then the US. So it all happened quickly.
So you can sell the second book before it's even written?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was sold on the idea. I mean, the idea changed a bit, but so that's I kind of had to commit like that at that day. At, like, what is this idea
going to
be?
I put down the wine. I'm going home to start writing my book.
Yeah. Yeah.
Shit. Some time.
Yeah, it was great. It was like so lucky and so wonderful that it happened that way. And so then when after that book deal happened, I had like a year and a half until The Push came out, and I worked on The Whispers during
that
time.
Do people in the industry just know, oh, we got a hit book on our hands? Because you sign the thing and The Push comes out a year and a half later.
Mm-hmm.
So who is it? Because your friends at Penguin just sent them out to agents and they're like, this is really good. Like, how do people know?
Yeah. So I didn't go through Penguin. So I did it all like independent of Penguin. And then we ended up selling it to Penguin when we were doing the Canadian book deal. I don't, you know what? It's like, I wish I could explain it. It's like this, it's all kind of like a timing thing and an energy thing. And I feel like I had this really great agent who just knew, like the way she would say it is the reason she sold it so fast to the UK was because she said, I know that UK editors are looking for something just like this, like right now. And it's like a bit of a building of hype, right? Like it really is an industry that's really like susceptible to hype. I think like you can, and it's like you have the right agent and then the right editor buys it really quickly overnight. And then, you know, the next market knows that that's happened and then there's excitement there. And so it all just kind of builds from there, and I don't know how to explain like what book it happens to and what it doesn't, but I think a lot of it is just,
but the agent read it the early, like it wasn't finished it was mostly finished.
It's different than what it is now. Like I edited it a lot with the editors, but it was finished. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then they're like, this looks really good. I know we can get
exactly. Yeah.
Did you feel a lot of pressure with the second book?
I did. Yeah. I felt a lot of pressure with the second. It was really hard. I felt like writing it was really hard. And I revised it a lot. And I was also writing it like a lot during the pandemic. I don't know how you guys felt about like,
weird time.
It was so hard, like creatively. It's funny, like some people say, like I have friends that like wrote a book the fastest they've ever written during the pandemic and felt like it was finally this chance to like focus and the creativity was right there. I had like the opposite experience where I think it's maybe because I had small kids.
I could always feel the kids in the other room. Even if they didn't come in, the prospect of them coming in was enough to make me feel like they were in the room.
Exactly.
And I'm like, can you get them out of here? You know, every noise I could hear. So
I felt the same way. I like couldn't get away from them. And I was struggling in those days. Like I was like,
you write in coffee shops typically,
right?
I
usually do. I never write at home. I always write in coffee shops and I couldn't go to a coffee shop. I couldn't even like, you can't even leave your house. It was just, I found it like stifling. Like,
do you wait till they're asleep?
So tired at night and they were like, tough. It was just such a terrible time.
That's the big fallacy about parents. Like I'll do it at night after they go to bed. But then once they go to bed, you're kind of like, all I can do right now is either fall asleep or just I'm going to watch an hour of TV or
exactly.
whatever that is.
I had like nothing left to give writing. Like how did you guys find? Were you guys doing your like working on your show at that point?
Yeah,
It took a minute though. Like the first, I was useless for the first like few months of the pandemic or whatever. I was like basically just in family mode. Do you know? I don't know. Did you get anything creative done early on?
Well, I wasn't scared, but I'm an anxious person. And then when something actually happens to warrant being anxious, I can actually.
Yeah, you were taking all your money out of the bank and changing it for gold or something.
That was Mike. Mike was doing that.
I gave him an offer based on my brother-in-law is also kind of a smart financial guy. It's like take cash out, and he was on it early. This is like December. He's like, I've been watching China, the markets. He had like a meeting with us about the pandemic. Where he's like, are you guys planning? And Danik and I were like, yes, we hadn't planned a fucking thing, but we acted like because we want to seem like bad parents. And then so I went to work, and I'm like, this thing's going to actually happen, and you should take your money out because that's anyway. So we all took out cash. Now looking back, it's like, why did we think that?
I didn't take out cash.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
I thought my advice was worth something.
I took it seriously, but then I also I realized that you're not normally that anxious of a person.
No.
So it gets scary when life hits you.
Yeah.
Whereas me, I'm always prepared for it. So I just had worked really hard to like keep my job. So I'm like, I'm gonna write two scripts a day for my job, but all my side projects I kind of put on hold until the pandemic. I realized it was there for a while. And then I started like, you know, a family podcast and TikTok accounts and everything.
Right.
But it did take about 8 months before I could actually do side pursuits.
Yeah. And I mean, you were
Yeah, it was a weird time for all musicians.
You started doing that show, like that Instagram show.
Yeah, Flatten the Curve Music Class, where we were just like teaching people how to play guitar on Instagram
more
live.
More importantly, Ashley, did you take out cash in preparation for the pandemic?
No, I did not.
My husband's like a finance guy. He knows better.
I hated every day. Like, I just was, I don't know, with two kids. Like, I'm not great like with being home with the kids anyways. Like, that is not, I'm just not like a, I can very much relate to Whitney in the book. Like,
I was just going to say, I didn't want to offend you, but yeah.
No. No offense taken, but thank you. But yeah, I felt, I'm not like that engaged. I don't love to, like, you know, be playing and doing stuff at home. And it was like, that was all there was to do. I found that so hard, because all I wanted to be doing was writing, was working. So I was like a mess those days. It was bad.
You know how the book deals with default parenting a lot, with Blair being the default parent, and then she envies Whitney's life, and then Whitney's not the default parent, but she still feels like she's not measuring up to being like what a mom should be. Do you feel like that when you don't want to be that default parent or don't necessarily enjoy playing with the kids?
Yeah, I think I do. I think I do feel, and it's so funny. I feel like I was just about to do the thing that I always do, which I'm trying not to do, which is when I'm going to be like honest about something with motherhood, I always want to say, but you know, I love my kids so much and they're so amazing. Yeah. And I'm trying to like stop doing that. But it's funny. As a side thing, I was having a conversation with someone who is also working creatively on like stuff around motherhood, like writing and directing. And we were having this great coffee and chatting and talking about motherhood in like this really honest way, and like really relating to each other. And I was hearing about her work and it was so great. And then I kept thinking I felt like we were playing a game of chicken. Like I felt like it was who's going to say it first?
Are you going to say it?
And I really was just waiting for her. I kept thinking, I wonder if she's going to do it. And I thought, I wonder if I'm going to do it. Like, I wonder if I can just leave this conversation without being like, oh, but like, I love my kids and they're so great and they're so cute. And isn't this a cute stage? And in the end, we both did it. We both like got it in there and then probably felt better about ourselves. But it's so funny how we feel the need to do that. But back to your question. Yeah, I do feel this sense of like, I think especially when you're doing something creative, when like creativity, when you're pursuing something, like whether it's like writing or I don't like music or acting or like anything that's creative, you almost feel like it doesn't count in some ways as this like thing,
as a pursuit, like a responsibility like or something like that.
Totally.
It's like if your husband goes to work, you're like, he doesn't do an important number stuff and he's bringing home money for us or whatever. But it's like, but if it feels like I need time to myself to think about a made up world I'm building right now.
Exactly.
That feels so frivolous. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And sometimes I think like, I talk to my kid, like I try to be really transparent with my kids about like work time. Like, I'm working. I'm not just sitting at a coffee shop all day, you know, like trying to communicate that to them. But so, yeah, I think I struggle with that a bit in terms of like value and trying to show, I don't know, time away from your family or away from your kids, pursuing the thing you want to do.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm not the default parent. Not that there needs to be a default parent, but that's just the situation we're in. And I don't feel guilt about it. And I'm wondering, do you think that will ever change where a woman who doesn't want to be the default parent and chooses to pursue interests outside of the home will ever stop feeling guilt or shame surrounding that, or embarrassment around other moms, like they have to pretend?
I think that that is one of the things, like obviously women have come like so far in society in so many ways, and there's like all examples that we can talk about, but I do feel like that exact thing you're talking about has not changed, and I don't know if it ever will. I honestly don't. I feel like that's this one thing that we seem to really hang on to. There's a quote at the beginning of the book about feminism and motherhood and being like a wife, you know, and the quote is by, I don't want to butcher it, so I'll just read it. But it's by an author, Rachel Cusk, who wrote very like honest memoirs about the end of her marriage and about motherhood. And she really was vilified for them at the time. Mm-hmm. This was like 15 or 20 years ago. And she was doing an interview actually with the Globe and Mail. And I after I finished her books, I was doing like a deep dive on her, you know, just her interviews and stuff. Cause I loved her book so much. And she said this in the Globe and Mail, that what I increasingly felt in marriage and in motherhood was that to live as a woman and to live as a feminist were two different and possibly irreconcilable things. Mm-hmm. And I read that and I was like, oh, that's so true. Like, I think there's so much truth in that. Although I think there's a lot of women that would be really uncomfortable with that idea and wouldn't agree with it or wouldn't want to agree with it. But I think it is this idea, exactly what you're saying, Shane, that I feel like, I think especially our generation, like millennials, we sort of have grown up with like such a strong feminist message, like being thrown at us all the time, right? It's like you grew up feeling like you can do it all, you can have it all, that like, you know, the equality, like in so many ways, like during your really formative years, like feminism is such a huge part of all of our identities. And then the reality is you enter into this very like domestic life of, you know, being a partner or being a mother. And all of a sudden, like you feel like you can't, like you don't have that anymore. You know?
Like it's hard to win. Like even if you don't care, you're being judged and you care about the judgment that other people are bestowing on you.
Yeah. Exactly that. Yeah. So I just think that when I read that quote, I was like, ugh, that is truth. Like that is hard truth. Yeah,
because I think that's what the book gets to too, is that there's just like different types of moms. But and as you say, like there's little room for that seemingly in our culture. Whereas like there's lots of room for different types of dads, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's dads that are away on business all the time. There's dads that are at home working. There's dads that are not in the picture at all, but show up sometimes. You know what I mean? Like there's a spectrum of people go, that's just my dad's not around, or my dad's around all the time, or, you know, but with moms, it's like, you're either like locked the fuck in every day being a domestic, what's the term?
Default parent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or you're not, you don't care as much or something.
Totally.
And that seems very unfair.
Yeah, sometimes if you are the man and you're the default parent, it's different. Mm-hmm. You can be judged for that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But am I able to read the opening sentence? I'm always fascinated by the very first sentence of a book. Sometimes I don't read much, but I do like reading the first sentence.
Spoiler alert.
Okay, it's just one sentence.
I'm just kidding. The first sentence in the book.
He lifts two fingers to his nose and smells the child's mother as his eyes grow wide in the dark of his kitchen. So that's pretty like,
you
bam.
Wanted this to be an erotica pie ever since day one, and now you're getting it.
I was going
to
say, that's why I was like, that's why Max recommended this.
I did like the snooping around.
Okay,
the
hold on a second. Let's just say to we're going to say to our listeners right now, this is the line. This is the line where we are now crossing over to talking exclusively about the whispers in a way that nothing is off limits, spoilers and all. No, I like this.
I wasn't trying to go into spoilery territory,
but I think it's a good time to flip it over.
Let's do that.
You know? And so we're good to talk about this, starting with that line. Would you like to read it again?
Yes.
Okay.
He lifts two fingers to his nose and smells the child's mother as his eyes grow wide in the dark of his kitchen. Now, how much effort was put into just that opening line, knowing how much pressure it is for authors to come up with that great grabbing line? Did you do it last? Did you do it first? Did it change like a million times until you had it just right?
Oh, yeah. Good question. I think that I did... yeah, a lot of, I revise a lot. Like I rewrite a lot. So usually when I first start writing, it's not, it will end up differently. Like it will, I sort of write the first kind of few takes of a book, I'm just writing to get everything down, like just to make sure that it's all there. And then there's a phase when I go back and like really pay attention to the writing. So I feel like I feel like that came in a bit later. But yeah, I think opening lines are so important. I agree with you. And like the opening and the ending is really important to me as a writer to like, to get people right away and to set a tone right away with the first few sentences.
Yeah.
Feels important to me. Yeah.
So when I was reading,
thank you for mentioning that. That's nice.
I was like, at times I got emotional reading the book. At times I got like turned on, like, you know, I was scared. Like I felt everything, honestly.
Can you say that again? Yeah.
Turned on. Yeah. There's no normal way to say that. Yeah, I feel weird saying that.
But all on the GO train too. You were going through the spectrum of emotions every
work,
day.
Mike and I worked together. So at work, I was like, were you like turned on and all reading this book? And I'm embarrassed. Mike's like, yes. So I didn't feel as weird saying it here. But obviously, like, you want the ride to be fun or like a roller coaster as you're reading it. But how much of a takeaway when the book's done do you want people to have? And what would that takeaway be if there is one?
I think exactly what you said. Like, I think
the entire ride, baby.
Middle section.
Yeah, I want a reader just to feel affected. Like, I think I just want them to feel something, whatever that is. And honestly, there's people that, like, I think both of my books are like polarizing in a lot of ways. Like there are people who just don't want to read about this. Like they don't want to read about this stuff. And they feel like it's either, like, to me, it maybe that comes from it being too close to the truth or too relatable or uncomfortable. Like I like writing uncomfortable stuff. Like I like to kind of just go there and go to the uncomfortable place. And that's not going to be for everybody. And so even when I get feedback from people that'll be like, who didn't like the book or they were like angry the whole time they're reading it, like I'm totally good with that. Like that's okay. If it made you angry, wonderful. Like that's an emotion. That's a takeaway. That's affecting, you know.
I told my mom to read the book and she loved it. This was the text, finish The Whispers, excellent book. I'm like, right, what a finishing line. She goes, oh yeah, that kid is nasty, but then so is his mother, Whitney.
Says the name.
So is his mother, comma, Whitney. That kid is nasty.
He's been in the hospital for months.
He's just telling the truth ultimately, right?
He's got a weird relationship with his mom.
I loved that. That was funny.
Okay, about Whitney, if we're in spoiler territory.
Yeah.
Okay, Mike and I were kind of debating this, and I hope you can give us a definitive answer, because I know sometimes authors are like, what do you think? But... was she dreaming when she was pinching the tubes to cut off the oxygen?
Because it's intentionally ambiguous.
Intentionally ambiguous.
And he wants a definitive answer.
Yeah. But this is for people who've already read the book, you know.
Yeah.
So
to me, in my mind, I think she wanted to do it desperately, but didn't. I think
she didn't. Shut up, Mike. Yeah. Mike thought that
too. I think that that was an escape. That was something that she wishes she could do. And whether or not she did it just for a second or not, she wouldn't have gone through with it. But it was like so close that she could taste it. And that did something for her. Yeah.
Got you.
Also, in a narrative sense, at this point, we didn't know the outcome of what happened to Xavier. So it helps plant the seed that maybe she would have some sort of nefarious intent or would go that far with the child.
It even makes it juicier, though, the fact that he lived.
Talk about spoiler alert.
We're in the book.
We're in the zone right now.
Okay, go ahead, Max.
When it comes to like dropping tea leaves, because Mike was bragging to me earlier just before you arrived, being like, I knew it was Ben the entire since page 80.
I think he flipped forwards.
Yeah.
That's my theory.
Absolutely not. Specific point. It was when, so throughout the book, you did this thing that just as a sort of literary device, each chapter is sort of based on the person's POV. So if it's a Whitney chapter, it starts with Whitney. If it's Rebecca, it's Rebecca. It was the first time you actually doubled up. You did like POVs in a row. So it was like Rebecca had a stacked thing. And then at that point, I start going, I'm like, we haven't seen Aiden sleep with Whitney, and she's kept him off the board a long time. And then just economy of characters, my brain started going. It was awfully, obviously still a wallop. And I had some other theories that were wrong, but that one was right. I absolutely did not flip forward. I would never go ahead and look and try and score points with you guys.
Yeah, I believe you. I do.
Yeah. So, okay. But the art of that is so interesting, because that's what makes any great book great or a TV show great, we're like, oh, that thing that happened, which I wasn't paying too close attention to.
Catch,
little things like that. How much of that needs to get developed? Like, is that a conversation you're having with your editor? Like, you know, let's move that, like, that sentence up to the fourth chapter instead of leaving it to the sixth. Like, I'm just really interested in, like, the strategy and planning that.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's, I think that all comes in the revision. Mm. Like, I feel like, because it's almost, you know, the weird thing about writing a book is that you get so close to it that there comes a point where you can't see it anymore, you know, like, and then you need feedback from other people to be like, this wasn't surprising. This was surprising. Like, so yeah, that my editors helped with that a lot, like giving feedback to just say like where things felt like you're revealing too much or not. And I worked on that a lot. Like, I worked on the shuffling around of chapters and to exactly what you're saying, Mike, like the reveals in a certain place. And I think what's interesting is that you want to give the reader enough so that, like, you don't want things to feel entirely out of left field. Right.
No. Mm-hmm.
Because then then as a reader, you almost feel like, well, what the fuck? Like, I've been taking on this ride. That's like, it's not earned. Exactly. Yeah. And so you have to give the reader, it's probably very similar in, like, you know, anything like TV, any other kind of writing too, but that you have to give the reader enough that they feel satisfied by, and you kind of want them to almost to see things coming, but the trick is to give them enough that that happens at the right point and not too early.
And when it is revealed, you go back and the breadcrumbs were perfect.
Yeah.
So you go, oh,
yeah.
This is earned. And also, I don't think it was obvious. I'm like that guy that goes to a magic show and I'm trying to learn the fucking thing that's happening before it happens.
Yeah.
So my brain was already doing a bit of that. And
which
then
is
it was
part
fantastic.
Of the fun, right? That's like part
so
of the fun.
You're like Matt Damon in Good Will Hunting.
Yes, I'm at the chalkboard figuring out the whispers. It was great. Well, you know, speaking of the characters, I'm really curious to know if you know in your mind what has happened, where all these characters are at post the book. Like, in your brain, when you think about Rebecca, like, what's her life like now?
Aww.
I worry about her, you know? I hope she's happy.
Yeah, that's a nice question. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think with some of, yeah, like, I do kind of think about it. Like, I definitely, like, when I'm done the book, I kind of let it go and because I want to, like, make space to move on to something else, you know? So I don't, like, linger there. But yeah, I think depending on the ending, like, there are, yeah, certain characters where, where I do want good things for them. Like, I think Rebecca seems to be everyone's favorite character.
Yeah.
Like, I hear, obviously, just everyone wants, like, a better ending for her than what happens in the book.
Yeah.
And I did feel bad about that ending for her, but I also felt like it was just the thing that was going to happen. Like, there's a bit of that. Like,
absolutely.
You sort of believe in a fate of a character and it's hard to change your mind on that.
So do you think she and Ben break up?
Yeah.
Oh, well, big time.
Yeah.
Do you think she has a kid with somebody else?
I think she'll maybe have one eventually.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's nice. Do Whitney and Jacob
like
stay together? They do. Because Jacob's just down for whatever.
I think they do.
No, 100%.
Honestly, yeah. I think that he doesn't
Jacob's got all the confidence in the world.
Well, no, he knows. He just doesn't want to know.
Yeah,
I think
like,
he doesn't,
you can
exactly.
whoever you want.
I think he doesn't want to know. I think he just, it's a bit of blinders for him. It's like
didn't
a blind
Rebecca
eye.
Rebecca and Ben break up in the book?
Yeah.
Kind of
they
like
they
kind of
do, yeah. 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 Yeah.
Oh, you thought maybe that was just the word, I'm not having kids, but
yeah.
We'll,
yeah.
Okay.
No, yeah.
Okay. The one moment that is sort of just touched on briefly is that because you're kind of assuming that Aiden is just a horn dog and he's just like up to no good and kind of lazy, right? He's just kind of that lazy, horny guy. And then it's sort of revealed
that old type.
When she was building out her profile character bubbles on the chalkboard or whatever, that was
lazy.
Horny.
Question mark.
Aiden.
Yes.
And it turns out that he is having an affair, but just with some floozy down at the bar, right?
Well, it was Jacob's friend's younger date. You know what was? Yeah, go on with your question.
She, finance? Did she work in the finance?
Why is she a floozy?
Just casting judgments. Yeah, sorry, I shouldn't say that. But was there some kind of fancy car?
What an antiquated
phrase. It was her fault. She tricked.
This is the 1920s pod. She was a floozy. All the guys with the speakers.
We're gonna end that up.
We're keeping every bit of it. Go on.
When you're trying to find an answer for Aiden, like was he? Because for a while, it kind of had me duped. I was like, oh no, he's just a nice guy, maybe a little bit lazy.
He just tries on condoms sometimes.
leaves his key around. What was great with Ashley Graham, the character, within Blair feels all this guilt about being judgy, yes. right? And so the reader then has this sort of moment where they're
like, oh, Aiden's actually not so bad. I was actually kind of relieved
exactly.
for Aiden. And then you're like, oh, it turns out he
great
was
Whitney
doing it.
Great Whitney scene, by the way, where she basically kind of protects her friend.
Thanks,
and we see a bit of how Whitney feels about Blair, which Blair feels like Whitney's sort of always in arms. But then you realize that like Whitney gets a lot of Blair too and has these sort of like this protective. Anyway, it was a fantastic scene where the girlfriend shows up or whatever, the affair.
Yeah. When did you come? You're like, oh no, Aiden is actually kind of up to no good too. Like, where was that? Because it's not that relationship isn't sort of discovered in any deeper way than just go, oh, she showed up one day and.
Yeah. I always knew that about Aiden. I feel like I always knew that Aiden was cheating on her and I think that's like, no matter how you feel about Blair, that ending validates a lot about her, you know.
She gotta listen to the whispers.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She knows.
Yeah.
Even though she did know.
And I think that there's a lot going on in their relationship. Like, there's some gaslighting, there's a lot of and her just not, I think, in the same, almost like in the same way that we see Jacob do. Like, Jacob just doesn't really want to know the truth because he knows the consequences are too big. And Blair is doing that as well, right? Like, I think Blair sort of, she's in that same place where she sort of knows, but she doesn't want to face it because she knows the consequences are going to be too great. And she's sort of just scared of like what that means for her life. But I always knew that Aiden was up to no good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's been the most interesting like fan feedback that you've gotten from someone who goes, oh, this is so relatable, or this made me find my cheating husband, or this sent me on a new path? Have you got anything interesting? We get lots of weird stuff from songs that we've written.
Oh, interesting.
Where people have found their cheating husband.
Exactly. Anything of note that comes to mind? They're like,
I get a lot of reader emails, like a lot of reader emails and messages, which I love reading. They're fascinating to me. But a lot of people saying that they I get a lot of messages from people who've just ended a relationship or ended a marriage. That seems to be like, and then people writing to me being like, this is exactly how I felt, and it validated kind of a lot for them. I've had a lot of that. I've had a lot of people reach out to say like, oh my God, I relate to Whitney so much. Like, she is like a lot about Whitney,
which is
interesting. Cause I feel like she's the easy one to
she's like the antagonist, but also the protagonist.
But it speaks to Shane's theory about, or just what we're talking about, feminism and wanting to have your own life and career and feeling like you're not doing best, doing your family right. And all those themes.
But she's also wildly duplicitous in having multiple affairs. Like, there's things that beyond just sort of to make her, I guess, like reprehensible or whatever, if you were to judge the characters. Like, you said that a lot of people, however you feel about Blair, do a lot of people have like a negative reaction to Blair?
I think a lot of people want Blair to come across stronger than she does at times. Like, a lot of people want her to have like this big redemption, like redeeming thing at the end.
Yeah.
And I think people are maybe would find frustration with that. But to me, that's not her ending. Like, that's just not who she is.
I think you captured something very real too about the idea that it's like, she knows she's not happy. She finds Aiden sort of repulsive in a lot of ways, and she's sort of annoyed by him all the time, but she doesn't want to blow up her life. Like, she's like, the alternative to this is she walks through the apartment and she's not going to actually, but it's like every time she plays the mental chess with the three moves down the road, it's just not preferable to her current situation. I think a lot of people end up in that situation, whether you're staying in a job or a partnership or whatever that is. To me, that makes Blair sort of the most realistic, and her outcome sort of feel that way.
But Whitney didn't want to blow up her life either, even though she apparently had everything. She still she wanted to keep that.
Yeah, and I think that's all so exactly kind of what I hope people would take away, and what I wanted to write about. And I think like the common thing here, like what everyone is going through in the book is like midlife, right? Like, what happens in midlife? And that, I think that was my sort of like the thing I was sort of obsessed with this book, was that idea of like millennial midlife, you know, like, what does that look like for us right now? Is like such a fascinating topic to me.
I know, because like, there's so many, we know so many people that are like now in their early to mid 40s that are going through divorces.
Yes.
You know, you go from, 12 years ago, everyone's getting married, and then half your friends are in divorces.
Yes. It's that time in life right now. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think it's also, and I like, there's this really great, article in the New York Times, like from the spring, that I'll send you guys if you're interested. But it's all about like millennial midlife, like how this generation's midlife looks so different than all the midlife periods and generations before us, like especially boomers, which like our parents are of that generation. And there's all these reasons why, right? Like so many really interesting, like socioeconomic reasons why our lives feel so different right now. But like for so many of us, we're like, you know, late 30s or mid 30s when we're having our first child, mm-hmm. right? Our families, like now when we're in midlife, if we choose to have a family, like usually our families are so much younger than any generation previous, right? Like economically, financially, we're like collectively in so much more debt. Like there's not a lot of home ownership. There's not like we're just in such a different place. And then our generation has also had this like crisis after crisis after crisis that generations before us never had, right? Like there was like, I know a lot of us graduated into a recession, and then there was 9/11, and you know, on and on, there was like another economic recession, and there was COVID, like the pandemic.
School shootings all the time. There's a million like, things in the news that are, we're sort of, what is like desensitized to trauma in a weird way.
We've had like such a different experience, I think, leading up to this point in midlife. And so what is that like? Like, I feel like in our parents' generation, like the midlife crisis was like this thing that like men had, right? When they were like feeling unappreciated because they made all the money and they bought a car and like they were like, peace out to their family and that was it. And
go for a pack of smokes.
Like that was this idea of a midlife crisis. And now I think it just looks so different. Like, what does crisis look like? Because I think every generation, I think everyone hits some level or some experience of a midlife crisis, right? Like that point in life where you're like, how the fuck did I get here? Like what, like who was I? Who did I think I would be? Who am I really? And like, how do you, and I think for a lot of people, it's like the opportunity for change is shrinking, right? Yeah. Like you look, I don't know if you guys feel like this now, but like you look ahead and you're like, God, you only have like so many decades left. And if you want to do something different with your life, if you are unhappy, if you're not happy in your relationship, if you want a family and you don't have one, if family life is not for you, but that's what you've committed to, like those are all really hard positions to be in, right? And it all happens like now. Like that's, those are the feelings that we're having now, right?
Does the article say how that's manifesting itself? Like in, for our, my dad, it would be buying a car, leaving the family. Mm-hmm. Like how are people doing it now?
Start podcasts.
Sketch shows.
Sketch show,
No, but you know what's so interesting about that is I was thinking, which I loved, by the way, I was telling you guys before we started recording, but
he's so middle-aged, this guy. I was thinking
like, it's so cool and so interesting that you guys did that at this point in your life. Right. Yeah. Like, and it's a total compliment because I think, and I feel like that a bit about my books too. Like, I guess my first book was published when I was like 30, I don't know, like mid-30s. Yeah. Like
is that
mid-30s.
Like a late bloomer in the literary
world?
Yeah,
like kind of. Yeah. And I feel like, and then I have this whole other, like my life feels so, it's like a totally different life than I thought. And that's a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. Like we all are in such a position of privilege, right? That we are doing creative things and we are like, just, we're so lucky. And for you guys to be starting something that means so much to you, that's so big and so cool. And like the thing, I'm presuming the thing you really want to do with your life right now is so cool. Like that's very rare, right?
I think almost because I was turning 40, it gave me a now or never type of approach. So that it was like a deadline. And I've always been a procrastinator. So knowing that deadline was approaching, it's like, we have to do it. We have to shoot a pilot. We have to have interstitials. We have to have Max do the theme song. We have to attach all this stuff to it to make it undeniable. And I think if I was 30 and I had been 30 trying to do similar pitches, they wouldn't have been as good or as desperate as it was being 40. Yeah.
So, okay. When you have a massively successful book, you might have an opportunity to get an option into a miniseries. How does that work? Okay. Cause, and where are we at?
Would you prefer miniseries or movie? Do you feel like your book needs
miniseries,
need more time to be told?
Because that whole part of it is always so fascinating. When you read a book and you go, oh, this could make such a great TV show. And that's what I was thinking the entire time. And that's happening with The Push. And it's, is it, happening with the whispers yet?
So with the push, it's been optioned for by David Heyman or Heyday Television, which has done a lot of cool projects that I really loved. And
name
I feel
them.
Well, he was a co-producer on Barbie, but also Harry Potter. They did a movie I loved called Marriage Story. I don't know if you guys saw that.
There was no bomb back then.
I can't watch that. That's too depressing for me.
I loved it.
Oh, man, the one fight in the like the motel.
Yes,
is like.
Such a good
we actually
scene.
Based a sketch on that.
Yeah.
Oh,
like,
which
yeah.
one?
It's deep. It's the one with me and Bella as the skunk comes costume.
Oh, yeah.
And she's like, get a real job. And he's like, it is a real job, Bella.
Yes.
Just like a comedy take on that.
Okay,
you know,
cool.
Puts food on the table, but it's a bunch of gumballs and shit.
Right. And Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, like just they had done really cool stuff. I was really excited to work with them. And, that's hopefully will all happen. There's, a really great screenwriter involved and a really great actress involved, which I have to be annoying and say, I can't say who it is, but, yeah.
But maybe after the podcast.
Maybe after. Yeah.
Who is it, Mike? You must know these things.
my intuition.
But it's really exciting and it's been fun. That process has been fun. And then, going through that process right now with The Whisperers, kind of just deciding sort of what to do with
Can
it.
Can I do the music for it?
Yes, I would love to.
That's a bond
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's on the pod. Yeah. Would you like it to be a movie or a miniseries?
I think TV.
It's a longer story.
Yeah, because I think with the four different characters, I think a lot of times it comes down to just logistics. Like if you need to give everyone enough screen time, I think like 6 or 8 hours would probably do the story more justice than.
Do you know anything about writing scripts?
No, I don't. I've been wanting to learn, like learn through just, I mean, I read, the pilot of The Push, which I could not have loved more. It was such a cool experience to read your work adapted. Like that was
and
just one episode, but
what happens if you
really
don't
cool.
love it though?
Well, I think it depends. You know what? In my case, like I am not, I can't like veto. If I didn't like it, I couldn't veto. In this case that I like in the structure that is for The Push, but some authors, and I also don't feel precious about it at all. Like I think, like I love the idea of someone who is like, that is their art. Like screenwriting is their art.
Their interpretation
I love, yeah.
Of the
like I love the idea of seeing something through someone else's lens. Like I don't feel that protective about it at all. But some authors really want to be heavily involved in that and they want to be able to give notes on a script. Like I didn't give notes on it. I just kind of read it when it was at a certain stage. But the person adapting it is like, I would never dare say,
right.
like give them my notes on it. Like they're brilliant at what they do. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you have any, maybe you can't say, cause you never know if you don't get them, but do you have any actors in mind for the roles?
I really don't. Think about that. Like I know, I feel like sometimes I've had that question in interviews and I sort of just come up with something to say, but I really like the idea of not kind of thinking about that and then being totally open to what it ends up being.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Totally.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's wrap this up. Cause we got to eat these treats and, you guys got to get back to work and we got to go for a walk, but,
we all have our responsibilities.
Everyone gets a question or two and then we'll wrap it up.
We each get a question or two and then six questions.
Yeah.
Six,
here for the 40 minutes. Go on.
Okay, give us a book recommendation that for our listeners. It can't be an Ashley Audrain book.
Okay.
And you know us pretty well by now. What would we like to read?
Something about walking, apparently.
What would you guys like to read? Honestly, I would have said Tomorrow, but you've read that and you guys talked about that. But I really loved that I would have thought about for you guys. I don't know. I might have to get back to you on that. Something you would love.
What are you reading right now?
So I just finished a book that I am like obsessed with. It's called,
Why wouldn't I like it then?
Well, it's a little motherhoody.
Probably right.
But, it's called Sailor Soldier and it's by Claire Kilroy, who's an Irish writer. And I thought if there's anyone listening who likes kind of motherhood type books, it's literary and it's just so beautifully written. And it's,
what does literary mean?
Literary means like there's not much plot, like not much happens. It's a lot of like deep on a character, like scenes.
What are you?
I'm somewhere in the middle of like, I would like, it's called, people like the industry people would describe it as upmarket. Like it's, it's a little bit literary, but there's a plot.
I see.
Stuff happens. Yeah.
And next question. Are you working on your next book?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess you can't say anything about it right now.
Yeah. Not yet. But I'm working on
it.
Yeah.
Cool?
Yeah, I think so. Sweet. I don't know. I'm enjoying it.
Sweet.
The Chris Farley Show.
Is it cool?
Sweet. You're awesome.
All right, Mike, your turn.
I didn't have two in the chamber. Okay, I'm more of a go with the flow guy.
I have a question.
Oh, there you go.
So I don't read a lot of books. And
we should open with this. Yeah.
But I have trouble keeping track of all the characters. Mm. But with this book, you did a really good job of being like, Blair, Whitney, like
is that how you read each header every time you read?
Whitney, Blair,
Rebecca.
But it was really easy to keep track of everything.
So it's interesting because so the first book, The Push, was from one person's perspective, and it was really like tight first person. And I just wanted to do something totally different for the second one, just as like a different writing experience. And so I came up with this idea of these four different perspectives, and we kind of hop between the heads of each character. And it is tricky. It's tricky to do for that exact reason, that you want people to be able to follow what's happening and not get confused. And I think especially for like three of these characters, like they are just women around the same age, and there's not, you have to really differentiate for the reader as you go. So I tried to be really conscious of that when I was doing revising. But I think the other thing that I hope helps, that was important and fun when writing, is that you really, like, you learn about each, when you're writing four characters in the space of like a standard novel, the hard part about character development is that you just don't have as much space to like go deep on a character. And so you have to just try to be really like smart about that and get everything that you want the reader, you know, in a quarter of the space that you would in another novel. And the other thing that's really fun is that, which I think is very true to real life, is that, you know how you can, like we think we are projecting ourselves a certain way, right? Like we have an idea of how we are in the world and how we think we're perceived and who we want to project ourselves as. But even more interesting is the way other people perceive us. And you sort of learn so much about a character through the lens of other people.
Absolutely.
So it's this other way to like give the reader a lot of information a character, even though it's not in that character's voice. And I think that's hard. I think that's something that like I had to work a lot on.
I love that, because like Blair is sort of, you know, unhappy with herself in some ways, and she's envious, you know, of Whitney. And then
tough name for a challenging character too, Blair. You just said it. She didn't stand a chance.
But then when you see the way people look at her, like, oh, what an amazing mom. You know, she's there for her kids. She's such a good relationship. It's like, oh, that's so awesome.
It really gives like layers to us. You know, actually, you know what? I was thinking the other day as I was thinking about like this idea of multiple characters, something that does this so brilliantly that I feel like you don't even realize as you're watching. Did you guys watch Succession? I'm sort of assuming you watched Succession. Yeah. So that show does that like so brilliantly, right? Because you consider like the character, like it's hard. I think it's even harder to do through TV, but you understand each character so differently because of what another character says about them or thinks about them or interacts about them. Like that show just does it really, really well, where the character becomes so dimensional. Because they're always expressing these opinions about each other, you know, in a way that other shows like don't quite like nail in that same way, you know?
Okay. My last question, Marcus, what was his condition if he had one?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Thanks for asking that. I feel like people don't ever really ask that. Yeah. So, you know, I've had some people message me on like a DM or whatever to say, was that an autistic child? And it was not my intention for that child to have autism. But rather the condition that Marcus has is called, selective mutism. Mm-hmm. And it's actually an anxiety disorder. I did a lot of research on this in terms of like how it presents and how a child acts. But basically, in many cases, it is anxiety that makes the child really shut down and not want to be verbal. Mm. And it really is most severe in situations where they are anxious. And so in Marcus's case, like he has this father who just makes him so anxious and so unsettled. And so it is always within sort of that environment that he really withdraws and finds obviously so much comfort in his mother. Until that kind of goes away too.
How much research did you do for the book? Because I know there's a lot of hospital stuff. I know you give credit to some doctors.
So I did a lot of research on that. And then the other thing was the hospital stuff was, I think because I was spending so much time in the hospital, spent so much time in Children's Hospital, and I really wanted to write about something in that environment because I find that environment absolutely fascinating for some of the reasons you mentioned off the top. Like, just you're there, but it's not you that's sick. It's the child, and you're advocating for them, but there's just so many players and you're observing other families. And it's so interesting to me. And so I wanted to write about a setting like that. And actually, this was obviously not planned, but my son ended up, as I was working through revisions on this book, my son ended up having like a very major surgery and was in the ICU for a bit after. And I happened to be working on like the revisions where I was going through a lot of the medical stuff. And I had never been in an ICU like in that capacity before until he had the surgery. And then we were there for 3 days, and that informed a lot of the book, like just observing what that was like and taking notes on what that feels like and what the environment's like. So that was really helpful in an odd way.
What does your husband's colleagues ask him? Like, does he come and he's like, oh, you gotta tell you what Jerry was asking me about the book today.
What is going on at home?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I also think like family reunions and stuff.
The family stuff is weird. Like, I feel like I do, like, obviously there's a lot of sex in the book, like sex stuff, as we've mentioned.
Can you read that portion?
To me, that's just like fun to write. And it's just like a part of life. And so I just wanted to include it or have it as part of the book. But when you're writing, you're sort of not, or I really try hard not to think about anybody reading it. Like, you're writing the book you want to write. Yeah. And my favorite piece of writing advice is basically to write, like your parents are never going to read it, you know, you really have to do that. And I do struggle with that. Like after, like once it's out, you're like, oh fuck, I wrote all that stuff in the book and everyone's going to read it.
Do you ever do like a public reading?
Not of those parts.
Oh, you skip those, and then you know what happened.
Maybe she can bring you in for those parts.
Yeah. Guest speaker.
This is my friend Shane. He'll be reading the more salacious sections.
So I don't know. So those parts, even my cousins were like, are you going to like let grandpa read the book? And I'm like, I don't know. Like I just, that is a bit awkward, but whatever.
But also really, people are more adult than you kind of give them credit for a lot of the time. Yeah. You're like, oh, you know.
I totally believe that. Uh-huh. And like, I have zero issue with like, it's fine. It's That's really cool. just my parents. Yeah. It's really just, you know.
So. But also there's, you know, they must be so proud of the success. It's like literally like a 1 in 100 million kind of success story. It's so incredible.
Thanks. Thank you.
And it's amazing to know that you just wrote it around the corner and you're just like, the book felt so familiar. I know you intentionally didn't mention Toronto by name. It feels very Toronto. Was it sort of intentional to like, let's make it sort of, it could be any place in North America that has like a good city center.
Totally. Yeah. I feel like in both the books, I pictured this neighborhood, neighborhood. And I think I'll always do that probably just because I just like to write about the places that you know the best. Right. But I didn't name it only because I think as a reader, if I'm reading about a place that's like, say someone said a book that's like in Philadelphia and I've never been to Philadelphia or I have no connection to Philadelphia, I'm just less connected. Personally, I just feel that way. And so I wanted to leave it a little vague so that people could sort of picture somewhere that meant something to them or that they could feel. Yeah.
Nice.
Well, my question is, on the next book, will you come back again and be on the podcast?
I would love to. All right. Thank you.
Or just come hang out.
Is this the best pod you've ever done?
This was pretty good. This might be number one. And I do want to say thank you for reading it because I feel like, Shane, I know you're not a reader. Thank you for reading it.
I am now. Never again.
No, but I feel like, I was saying this to Max, that it obviously is like very marketed towards women or sort of packaged towards women. And I was so lucky to get like a New York Times review for this book. And the reviewer had said that this is a book that men should read, that like all men should read. And that was really meaningful to me. And it is meaningful to me that you guys would just put so much, just be so thoughtful about reading and speaking about this book. So thank you. I appreciate it.
It's a fantastic, thank you for writing it because it's fantastic. And I said on the pod that hasn't come out yet, but like I'd snuck away to an edit bay at the office to like finish it. You know, it's just one of those books and it was great to read. So thank you for writing it. Thank you for coming on this podcast.
She bicycled down to the house. Where are you going after this?
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, I have the whole afternoon off. I don't know.
It's a beautiful day.
Just cuts you two going for a walk.
It's whispers. Mara's watching.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks again.
So that's it. That's all. That's our episode. Thank you so much, Nathan Ash. Thanks so much to Manager Ash. This is a great hang. Maybe the best.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.